and find a way. Microcosmic. If I can sell 200, it sounds mad, but if I was to talk to my manager in the 80s, when we'd put an album out and our target was to try and sell 50,000 albums, he'd be disappointed if we didn't sell 50,000. And like now, I went from that extreme where the budget was 150 grand on my third album, the budget in LA was 150 grand. I went from that extreme to living in the Highlands and having the budget for £9. Another way.
Coming up in this week's show, we have the fantastic Martin Stevenson. Together with his band The Dainties, Martin's headlined Glastonbury, had top 10 albums, and been a pin-up from Top of the Pops. He's toured with the likes of The Smiths, Aztec Camera, and Edwyn Collins. But the amazing thing about Martin is his unique approach to songwriting and even life. I'm usually a data-driven kind of nerd, formula man, but this episode is totally different, as is Martin's approach. We hear about spirituality, cosmic forces, and a higher power to choose songs for Martin. Martin is one of the most genuine and happy people you can meet. The chat is a bit different, but I think that makes it super interesting. We hear about when it's best to introduce an instrument into songwriting, how Holy Humble Heart became a gay anthem, and also what it's like to play on the Isle of Egg. Without further ado, this is Martin Stevenson. Swim against the
sea. Musicians, we're like cockroaches, aren't we? We always find a way to survive.
Yeah, but I mean, I guess for you, you gig a lot, right? Sort of pre-lockdown.
Yeah. Funny enough, I felt it coming at some point. You know, I'm approaching 60 and I've been on the road since I was about 20. And I'm thinking, who am I? You know, what do I do? You know, I'm this middle-aged bloke that's toodling around like an old uncle that people could do without seeing, really. What'll happen when I roll up? You know, what'll happen in there? Kind of the lockdowns forced that to think like that and manage, you know, manifest work and find a way. Microcosmic. If I can sell 200, it sounds mad, but if I was to talk to my manager in the 80s, when we'd put an album out and our target was to try and sell 50,000 albums, he'd be disappointed if we didn't sell 50,000. And like now, I went from that extreme where the budget was 150 grand on my third album, the budget in LA was 150 grand. I went from that extreme to living in the Highlands and having the budget for £9.
That's quite a contrast, but like you seem to enjoy the challenge of it looking at you as you tell it, you know?
Yeah, it's a cosmic perception because like, in the 80s, my manager was, they were all like making money. But the trouble is you get enslaved in this whole corporate machine. But when you disconnect from it, the sad thing is a lot of people's mindsets is that they're not validated unless they're in the corporate machine. But I'm trying to say, don't go in there. It hurts. Don't go in there. Don't bother going in the termite mound. Everybody's empowered now and it's a level playing field. And on a microcosmic level, you can sell 200 albums and you can pay for your manufacturing and everything. You're not going into debt. You have you own your own material. So it's a smaller level, but it's much more cosmic. Actually.
So I'll make sure I do my plugging thing. What's the best way to acquire Martin Stevenson's current music?
Well, I've just got one place now and I just do it on Bandcamp.
Oh, on Bandcamp. We'll put links in the show notes. I bought your album, the Rock and Company Blue album, earlier today. It's really good.
Thank you. That's very kind of you.
I love how you're, because my podcast is called Song Stories. Yes. I'm watching you live. You're very good at almost blending the song into the story in between and things like that. Have you always done that, or is it more as the songwriting developed? Or
I think you develop as you get older. But I was always like, I mean, I wasn't much fun to be around in my early 20s. I was very, very serious about. I was into songs because I had a couple of experiences. I started off, I was a 16-year-old shoegazer with long black hair who was frightened to look up, you know, and the fringe was there to protect me from the world. And I was a new wave guitarist in 1977, you know, that couldn't speak because I was so shy. And from that, I joined a band called Strange Relations and I was a guitarist. And the lead singer was the man. He was like a guy called Steve Minto and he was like my hero and he was like a kind of a beanpole, bisexual, blonde-haired, pointy-nosed introvert. that had really good lyrics and was a songwriter. He was the first person I was exposed to as a songwriter. When I got sacked from that band, I was in that band, but I was so young and everybody else was 20 and I was like 16. I was like, yeah. And they were like, get rid of the kid. And the hurt of like...
What did you do to get sacked, can I ask?
I bought a flanger and I was getting right into the Cure. And I was like...
I mean, that doesn't sound too rebellious, that you're exploring the musical, you know, what you can do.
The guy, it's probably because I was younger than the other guys, but I was just really open, you know. They were cynical, they were quite cynical and sarcastic, and I was young and I was like wide open, and I got crucified and annihilated this. But what it did was I just suddenly kind of woke up and started writing my own songs, and that was when I went on my own path as a songwriter. And I was because I didn't feel like a proper songwriter, you know, I would like just channel. I used to channel crown chakra channel. You would call it automatic writing, or, you know.
Yeah.
If people are enslaved, the perception of the housing here, the head, you know, the little nut on our shoulders, our PC or Apple Mac with our storage units and all that stuff. But I've always had a wider perception of expanded consciousness beyond the head and the housing. To connect with the collective consciousness.
Where do you think that first came from? I mean, you sound a very spiritual guy.
It's non-religious. I mean, spirituality is so light, and it's so, we all have it. It's such a, there's nothing clever, but it's not like chemistry or science or anything. Spirituality is just love, kindness, receptivity. And the only thing I got right from a young age, I was receptive. You know, I had an awareness of like my lower self, the ego, which is very apparent if you're a bloke. We've all got them, you know. But you've also got your crown chakra. You've got your higher consciousness, what I would call your master puppeteer. You know, you are the puppet and also the puppeteer.
Okay. And
you are the guidance as well as the puppet that's being guided. So sometimes we as the puppet say, no, I want to go this way. I want to shag her and I want to sell this and I want to snort that. And your master puppeteer is going, it's going to hurt. You're not going to like it because I can see over the wall.
Yeah.
No, I want it. You know, and that's how we kind of manage ourselves from being the, and every now and again, if we're looking, we'll listen to the master puppeteer, you know, the angel as opposed to the demon. And we receive guidance. And usually if we follow guidance, and it's just like being in a quiet place and really listening, you know what I mean? The angels or whatever you want to call it are always whispering to us. Good thoughts. You know?
It sounds like, so you're saying about you left your first band, and I'm guessing maybe at that stage was the puppeteer not quite in control then, to use your analogy there?
I was a child, you know. But I definitely had a good, I was open. And that's how I got hurt. You know, if you're very open, you stand more to get hurt initially.
Mm-hmm.
But if you don't take it personally and realize that it's part of growth, you know, it's like a pod that you're breaking free from, and it feels physically, it's a kind of birth in a way. And we'll go through many births in our lives, especially if we're on a creative path, you know, because we'll have to face criticism, which is difficult for a lot of people, you know, to be criticized.
It's always more memorable, the criticism. Hey, I was speaking to a friend the other night and she's got like loads of music online. She said, I got one dislike on YouTube. I'm like, you've got 1,000 likes? She's like, oh, but this guy thinks I'm like... But anyway, she remembered like the one criticism, you know?
It's hard. It's like if you have a lovely skin and you get one spot.
That's a good day.
Time with the one spot. I've got a spot. There's people with acne that are really enjoying their lives. You know?
Going back to your songwriting then, you said you kind of started songwriting a bit then when you left the band.
Yeah.
Do you remember your initial efforts or like first song where you kind of thought, go on?
I can remember songs even before that. There's a couple of songs came through. I remember first song I ever wrote, I was about, well, what happened when I was about 11 years old, I had a friend called Willie McHugh, and we were runners, you know, even at that age, we were runners. He was a sprinter and I was a long distance runner. We were really into running. And one day I ran around the side of his house to get a glass of water, because you could do that then. You didn't need a lawyer. You could go to other people's houses and you wouldn't get accused of burglary. And I just went around the side of his house and to get a glass of water. And there was his older brother, Joe, sitting on the step. And Joe was probably about 19. He looked really old to me because I was 11.
Oh, yeah.
And I just stopped and I looked at him. It was a kind of Boo Radley moment. He kind of stood up and looked at me and I looked at him and he spoke. He was a beautiful guy and he just went, sorry. And he walked past me and I was like, I was in awe of him and I watched him. And he just walked around the corner. And that was the last time, the only time I saw him. Because 2 weeks later, he walked into a field in the outskirts of our community and he doused himself with petrol and he burned himself to a cinder. And I met him 2 weeks before it happened. And I remember seeing my mother weeping. All our community were devastated because he was really loved, you know. And he was an athlete and he was a student and he was suffering from depression. But in that little moment that God gave us to meet him, I didn't have the tools to anticipate what was coming. So I buried it and I carried it with me. And when I was 14, then I wrote the song, The Sad Tale of Joe McHugh.
For Brother Blue, I once so young could fall so soon, but he's free now as I'm telling true. This sad tale of a Joe McHugh. Could you keep your mind flew yourself, please?
And, you know, Joe would sit upon the step, his sadness hid, he needed help. Depression damped the sun that shone his fragile life would soon be gone. Doused himself to free his heart and sacrificed himself to his God. And I'm full of woe for Brother Blue, how one so young could fall so soon. But he's free now, as I'm telling true, this sad tale of Joe McHugh.
And wow, that's beautiful. And that was when you were 14?
Yeah.
And do you remember crafting it, or did the words kind of like...
Just channeled it, you know. And what I did was I was so frightened of it, and I hid it. I kept it to myself. And when I got to 30, by then I'd been writing songs and I was wide open when I was 30. It was a great age, 30.
You were in the Dainties on Top of the Pops and stuff at this age, yeah?
After I was a veteran, by the age of 27, 28, I disconnected from the industry and I went off grid. So I was a veteran by the time I was 25, 26.
But anyway, so you're saying this song when you were 30?
Oh. Yeah, I was, because then I went, in my early 30s, I was completely off grid and disconnected from the music industry, but I was wandering on my own little path all over Ireland and Europe and just wandering around connecting with people. I was on a spiritual path then, but I had no interest in any business or fame or industry thing. I was just on my own path connecting with people. But I got a message, I got like a connection saying, you know, you've got to share this song. You've had it since you were 14. Why are you not sharing it? Almost like a higher consciousness talking to us. And I'm like, well, you know. And it said, look, I'm gonna set you free on this. This is like in creativity and spirit. It said, you've got to stop focusing on the suicide and you have to see the suicide as a birth. Convert it to a birth. And it's not the suicide of a student anymore. It's the birth of an angel. And that concept that the guidance gave me, not my ego intelligence, my memory banks or, you know, out of the computer, that set me free to share that song. And I shared that song from then on in.
Is the song on Bandcamp and things? Can I hear it? I'll download it later.
It'll be somewhere. There's so many different albums on there. It'll be on one of the albums. I'll tell you, it might be on a Torag's album. Because the song, I had a rockabilly band in the early 30s. And I actually, because I was always fascinated with rockabilly musicians. You know, I knew this guitarist called Joe Gillen, and he was like a force of nature. He was from a rough background in North Shields. He was like a fighter and hard but beautiful in the quiff, and he had it all. He was like a good looking street fighting great guitarist, and I was in awe of him, you know. So I joined the band to figure out what the hell he was doing as a guitar fan, but I was an artist as well. So because I could pick Chet Atkins and bluegrass stuff and all that, I got Rites of Passage into his into the rockabilly scene. It's almost like being a bit of a from a different place, but you break bread with them and they allow you into their space, because the masters are what they do. They're like, they can do rockabilly like really authentically from the early 50s. Like, they all look fantastic and they do it like properly, you know. So through my little bits of skills of like Western swing guitar and stuff like that, I was allowed rites of passage, and I became great friends with Joe, and we formed a band called the Toe Rags. But the ironic thing is, like, rockabillys don't sing about the Buddha, you know. Rockabillys sing about cars and girls and pink Cadillacs, and yeah, but it's all cool. But when I got access as a kind of a Doctor Who within this little band, suddenly I did the sad tale of Joe McHugh, and Joe would turn around and say, "What the fuck are you on about?" Like, I'd say, "Oh, it's about a kid that got." But then he started getting it, and he's thinking, "Wow, this is cool." And we had another dimension as a rockabilly outfit, because of my art form with songwriting and always having strange concepts, and every song like would have a completely different range. That was the first thing you would spot in the Dainties. Their range from one song to another was insane. Where some bands have formula. Yeah. They get it for like Status Quo, they get a formula and it's successful, and it's like a drill, it just keeps drilling, you know. Well, I was like all over the place, and it all came from learning guitar.
So, in terms of like, because I've maybe met a few people and I'm really interested in Martin's songwriting, like maybe process or method, but I don't want to be too functional about it. But like, how do you go about writing songs, I guess?
I don't know, when we worked together, I mean, you stood out as a kid when you came down to the, what I loved about you was your openness, you know, and there was none of this like, fucking this and I'm that, you know, you're just like dead, you were curious. It works best when it's intuitive and curious, uh-huh. and not trying to be clever. So for me, you know, some people have brilliant analytical powers and they can craft and plan. If I do that, I'm useless. You know, I'd make a terrible serial killer, like. I'd have to stand up and down on a Weetabix, you know, to be a serial killer. It's just everybody's different. I mean, a peer of mine, Paddy McAloon from Prefab Sprout, we were complete opposites. Paddy can not experience something and write about it better when he hasn't experienced it.
Yeah,
you know, which is an amazing skill, and he can plan things like a jeweler, you know. But I'm complete opposite. I need to get in the zone to just like feel it, you know. But I titles are a good thing, you know. I like collecting titles or one-liners. It's good to collect a few things and keep your ears open.
But do you usually like noodle on the guitar and it kind of falls from the sky, so to speak, or do you record melodies in your phone, or? Like, how does it start for you?
Honestly, if someone got my phone now and listened to the recordings, I could get sectioned, you know? I mean, it's like, sometimes I have trouble deciphering what the hell I'm on about, you know? But there's definitely an essence. For me, the best songs I've ever written are ones that I'm just, like, in a way, a secretary to. And I've got a little bit of a facility on a guitar. I like having limited options, me. I can work better with limited options than too many.
Right.
Okay. So I consciously limit my options. But one thing there where I don't limit myself in that is guidance. Automatic writing, what you'd call channeling, you know. So most of my good stuff comes from channeling. So really I feel like for example, like I wrote a song called Something Special.
Okay.
And all it was like, if I was a painter, I would have just painted it, you know. But I can't paint very well, so that's my medium is song. So the concept that I was given was I could see a Jamaican guy. He was suffering from depression. He was in a little flat, and the dishes weren't done. The curtains he wasn't in a good place. And one morning, he kind of woke up, and it was all dark, but there was a pinhead of light just coming through the curtain.
Right.
So you could see this line of light, and it just distracted him enough to forget about the hell he was in. And he got distracted by that little bit of light, and it just triggered him back to being in a good zone. And the song's about him tidying up a little bit in the flat, putting his coat on and going around the corner to buy a bottle of milk. That's what the song's about. And on his trip to the milk, he's suddenly smiling at people, and he's like, he's a beautiful guy, and he's, you know.
And is that part of you in that story as well? Like, you know, appreciate. Oh,
I'm sure there is. Yeah, and I've had friends who suffered from depression, but what I can do is interpret really well,
right?
And then it become a soul song, you know, something special through my window. And when I start working with it intuitively, if you have a good connection with your higher consciousness and the creative force, so to speak, you know, we're all just being given gifts, you know, we're not the creators really. And when you have a good relationship with that, they've got such a team up in there in the collective, it's just an analogy, but they've got such a team there, you know. I'll listen to how they interpret what they're sending to me, and I'll say, why the hell do you want me to sing this song? You've got like Otis Redding up there, you know, I'm hearing it through my monitor, my inner, I'm hearing it complete. And I'm thinking, why the hell do you want me, a middle-aged Geordie, with, you know, on a good day, I sound like Julian Clary. You know,
oh, come on, man, you're underplaying yourself. You sound great.
I'm serious. Like, I mean, on a serious level, like, I can hear, you know, I can hear its full potential. And then it comes through my limitations. So my vocal or whatever it is, you know. I mean, I know sometimes your limitations are good, like Lou Reed and all that, but it's a kind of humorous thing, you know. But then to me, the spirit says, yeah, but we don't want imperfection. We like imperfection. We like your...
there's that phrase about there's a bit of an imperfection in perfection, if you know what I mean, or something around that. I'm probably misquoting here, but... Can I ask about a couple of your songs specifically then, to you, just the stories behind them and things?
Yeah.
I guess from your Dainties days, and I don't know if they're your personal favourites, but the Crocodile Crier song, which did very well at the time. Do you remember how it was... was it conceived or given birth? I'm not sure which phrase is best, but you know what I mean.
Yeah, I can tell you what was going on as well around there, because I went away on tour with a young songwriter called Roddy Frame, who had a band called Aztec Camera.
Oh, yeah, I like them.
And we called Roddy as 19-year-old, 20-year-olds. He was known in our songwriting circles and everywhere, really, as the Boy Wonder.
Okay.
And he was from East Kilbride. And I tell you what, man, I mean, I've gigged with the Smiths. I saw them live when I was in the early 20s. I played with them. And the press make their stars, you know. They make their stars. They're creative. If you fits with the press, they'll write you into history. That's what Morrissey understood, you know, and people like that. They become iconical because they've caught the press, and they, you know, sometimes they deserve it of it, sometimes they're not. It's who they know. But Roddy Frame was like, he was an unmistakable talent. He was probably like what Stevie Winwood was like. Jimi Hendrix was blown away when he heard Stevie Winwood in the 60s, because if you hear that song, keep on running, keep on hiding, that's Stevie Winwood. He's 15. He sounds like he's 75.
He's 15 when he sends wow, I didn't know that.
And he was a phenomenal keyboard player. He was just super talented. And when Jimi Hendrix saw him, he was like, fucking hell, who's this kid? Like, and Hendrix was a phenomenon, you know. And when I saw Roddy Frame, he was 17. And I supported him in Newcastle. And he was just outstanding, man. He's a guitarist. He was fine. He was doing, like, in the soundtrack, he was doing Wes Montgomery licks on this jazz guitar, and then he was doing this Brazilian jazz, just like outstanding musician, and then a singer, and then a poet as well.
Yeah, all that in one.
And a very beautiful kid, like, said all the girls wanted him, and he was like, nah. He was just so cool, man. And I went on tour with him, and I just absolutely loved him. You know, I loved him. Like, and he inspired me. I was a table tennis player then. I wasn't that bothered. You know, I was dabbling with music, but I didn't think I would have a career or anything with it. But when I met Roddy, he really inspired me. And I went home after we did three gigs in Scotland. We did Glasgow, Dundee, and Edinburgh. And he gave us 50 quid out of his own pocket to go and do Aberdeen. This is a 17-year-old kid, you know.
Yeah.
And we were only like 19 or 20, and we did that. And then we ended up doing another 10 shows all over the UK with him. By this time, he sang a Rough Trade. He was just going, whew. He went from Postcard Records, which was the hippest label in the UK at the time, from Glasgow. They had Orange Juice, Aztec Camera, and the Go-Betweens, Bluebells. They were just the best label,
yeah,
independent label run by an artist. So he came from there when he was 16, 17. He went to Rough Trade, dodged Rough Trade because they weren't a good deal, really. There was someone taking care of him. He just went from Rough Trade to Warner Brothers by the time he was 18. He was signed to him. He was a major artist. He had that quality thing about him, you know. And I just loved, I did some gigs with him and it changed my life. And on the interim of one of them, I went home and my grandmother was dying. My grandmother, who I kind of grew up with, really. And she was just a great woman. And I wrote Crocodile Cry for her.
So sorry about your friend. I heard he died the other day. That a team of tall armed men came and carried him away. Over where we church ground, where cracks like me lie together around. To river up into a...
Just after the funeral, you know. Yeah, but I had the spirit of writing songs with me. I really, it got enhanced by Roddy Frame, I would say. He really inspired me to take it seriously, you know.
Yeah, I guess. And at that stage in the Dainties, like, things were really taking off for you, right?
Yeah, we were like a little indie band, and we were on a little indie label in Newcastle called Kitchenware. And we were very inspired by the Glasgow scene, which was, because it was phenomenal what happened in the UK from 1976 when punk kicked off. Because it's kind of trivialized now, but if you were around as a young person when punk happened, it was like what the French Impressionist movement was in art, you know. It was massive.
So were you into punk growing up?
Oh, yeah. I was a 16-year-old punk rocker. Oh, yeah. It's the Clash, the Dan. It was totally anti-industry. It was like you could meet Joe Strummer, you could touch him. He wasn't like a demigod. He was fucking right in there with you. And punk rock was in the youth clubs as much as the venues. It was the young kids who owned punk. It was theirs, you know. But it happened really quickly in 76, 77, in London and Brighton, you know, that part. But it went everywhere. Tain had a punk scene. You know, Invergordon had a punk. The postman in punk in Invergordon, I was talking to him 2 days ago, he's been a punk since 1976 when I see him.
Brilliant.
He's got his damn T-shirts on still. He's got white hair. He's mental, you know. His whole life's been a punk, you know. But it moved very quickly from to the new wave. Like by 77, 78, punk was dissolving into the new wave. The new wave was kind of the Cure and all that and the Passions. There was all these student bands, the Delta Five. It was like a lushly creative independent music scene. John Peel was getting onto it, you know, the Mekons. It was just phenomenal. And it was nothing to do with the industry and pop stars and shite like that, you know. It was real Dickensian characters who were getting involved in the arts, you know. And the wave just moved from London, Brighton, up to Manchester. You know, because Manchester, there was a bit of a darker scene, but very creative. You know, like Joy Division, all of these great bands coming out of Manchester. And I just went up to Glasgow. And the great thing about Glasgow, when it happened with Postcard Records in 1980, Orange Juice came along, and Edwin Collins was phenomenal because he was like a big, bumbling, tall, good-looking oaf who was really sharp. He knew his music. He was into Velvet Underground, all kinds of stuff, but he could laugh at himself. He used to warble a little bit like, whoa. He was seen as like, but he was very funny. He wasn't like taking himself seriously.
Yeah.
And he was a brilliant ambassador for indie music. And he was the man, like around about 1980, Edwin was the man in Aztec Camera, you know, the Bluebells. Glasgow was just like on fire, you know, and we were inspired by the Glasgow scene because as Geordies we loved the Scots because you could swear at each other.
I mean, you're only a couple hundred miles up the road, you know what I mean? They're probably
we really identify with the Scots, like And so the Newcastle scene was, it was really bumped off and inspired by the Scottish scene.
Well, I suppose in that time in Glasgow, and it seems to come in like cycles, there was loads of bands, as you say, breaking through, and that you were part of that wave. But there was another Dainty song I was listening to today, the Holy Humble Heart song. I love that line about no time to kiss statues.
Aye.
You want to tell us about that song? And
yeah, because, you know, a statue to me is like a woman or a man, wherever your partner, whoever your partner is, wherever your sex or whatever.
It's like kissing someone, when nothing's there, right?
Yeah, someone who's not unfeeling, you know, like, you know, the wrong person.
For whatever reason, it resonated. There's no time to kiss a statue. Someone of beauty looks the part.
But that was it became a gay anthem. It was a supportive song towards anti-Thatcher, against Mrs. Thatcher, because she was attacking the gay community with that Clause 28 thing. And she, honestly, it was like fascism. They were removing gay literature from the they were like attacking the gay.
I didn't realize that.
Oh, it was like Mrs. Thatcher, man. So at the time that song came out, and I'd wrote it for a friend of mine that was gay, called Malcolm Hutchinson, and it became a bit of an anthem for, I mean, Holly Johnson used to love the song, and and I dedicated the song to the gay movement, is to say, look, I'm a young heterosexual, you know, but my mates are gay, my mates are black, Chinese, you know.
Did you play it to your mate first out of interest?
Sorry?
Did you play it to your mate first?
Yeah, actually, he would have heard it before.
Do you mind his reaction?
Oh, he loved it. I mean, he was a really close friend of mine. He was dead funny. I mean, I learned through him what it was like to be a gay person, how difficult it was. And he was very flamboyant, you know. He had a great defense. He used to terrify people. He could fight, you know. He was like, there was no shit with him, like. But we were just like, our sexuality was just like one aspect of our connection, you know. Like he went to school with my wife, so we were really close, you know.
Yeah.
So it was great that, and I got the opportunity to share that song and use it as a vessel to raise awareness, you know.
Tells me he is full of love, love, love. Let Malcolm to be no exception.
Lee, the songs like come quickly for you then, from initial idea to finishing.
The best ones do, I think.
Right.
You know, when I was about 29, I bought a book about how to write songs because I felt like I wasn't a proper songwriter.
I mean, that makes no sense, but go on.
Because I thought like my songs were all a bit weird and like, you know, they're not proper ones, and like, what's a proper song? And there must be a proper way. I was like getting insecure and thinking, no, I'm not a proper songwriter. And then I opened this book, and I was like, oh God, you know, it was all about planning and like putting hooks and things and checking the newspaper to see what's on the news to write about what's popular. And it was all like, I thought, oh, that's awful.
That sounds like the opposite of, yeah.
Yeah. So then I just went back to not being a proper songwriter.
Oh, come on, mate. You can't be saying that. You're a great songwriter. Do you always write on the guitar?
Sorry?
Do you always write on the guitar? Or have you ever written on piano or top lining? I don't know.
I started with because I started off as a guitarist. But sometimes, you know, when you pick a guitar, you'll have little patterns and it's a bit predictable. So then I would put them in open tuning so I didn't know what I was doing.
Right, okay.
I'm not quite sure then. It makes you think outside the box again. But I like also, I like, you know, writing a lyric and resisting picking the tool up, the instrument, because it'll influence you.
Yeah.
And then I like to look at the words and then just like try to get in a receptive state and try to sing the words off the paper and just see if there's any energy on the words that without using an instrument and try and sing them a little bit. And then hear a note and say, oh, that's in the key of D, that, or B flat. Oh, that's, yeah. And then maybe bring the instrument in later.
So, I love that, you know, in these like songwriting things, I've spoken to maybe like, I don't know, 30, 40 people on this, and no two processes really the same. But like yours is just like very intuitive, and you seem very happy doing it, and it's like very spiritual, to use your word earlier. Like, love hearing about it.
It's all about making mistakes, you know, like sketches, you know. I've always loved sketches, you know, because they're not finished. But someone's like, does a sketch, and they're going to put it in the bin. Go, don't put that in the bin. I'll have that. You know, it's lovely. You know, and I think songs can be like that. You don't have to, like, when people say, oh, you need a bridge in that song, like some A&R man with a record company, you need a bridge. Why does it need a bridge? What is a bridge? Usually a bridge is like, it sounds like it's a bit of another song that you don't know what to do, so you clang it in the middle of the, you know. I've never really liked bridges. One or two of them I like, but they just sound a bit awesome.
Love it. I think for whatever songwriting role you read, like, you can find somewhere like see Knocking on Heaven's Door by Bob Dylan. It's the same the whole way through. Goes on 2 minute verses, but it's one of the best songs ever. You know what I mean? There's always like something that breaks the rules.
He's brilliant.
True.
It's a title song, you know. He's rang with. He's got a lot out of that. You know.
he's
a brilliant narrator, you know. Dylan's a great singer, you know. Some people say he's not a good singer, but his voice works, and he's changed his voice so many times in little ways. But he's a brilliant narrator. He cuts through, you know, same as Lou Reed. Like, Lou Reed could read the paper and it sounds good, you know.
But I think those songs as well, like, they're just him and a guitar, but they capture an emotion amazingly. However he does it, you know what I mean? Whether it's magic or words play or, you know.
One more cup of coffee for the road, you know.
Yeah.
Going by is howling in the background. One more cup of coffee. They sound like two gypsies or something, you know. I love them. Like, I love Bob Dylan. I think he's fantastic. I love Leonard Cohen. I love this lady here. You know, Joan Baez, man.
Yeah.
What a great, you know, she opened the door for Bob, man. She let him, she got him through, you know, because he was a Woody Guthrie fan. He was doing pretty well in Greenwich Village as a harmonica player. But she spotted his talent and she introduced him. She initiated him to, like, Pete Seeger and all the hierarchy of the Greenwich Village folk scene. And before he knew it, Peter, Paul and Mary were doing his songs and all the folk fraternity. And he became the blue-eyed boy of the folk fraternity. What did he do? A year later, he got back into rock and roll. He pissed them all off, you know?
Yeah, I remember that legendary. He got booed, did he not, when he first, like, plugged in?
Oh, yeah, he got called Judas and everything like that. But he was only going back to his rockabilly roots and, like, enjoying a bit of rock and roll. He got in with, you know, the band, Robbie Robertson and all them lot, and Mick Bloomfield and all that. And he just wanted to play some rock and roll. He was just a young person, you know. But Dylan was a great teacher, you know, a great teacher of truth. I mean, he understood the whole business thing. He wasn't, you know, he accumulated great power, but the people who followed him and tried to copy him, that wasn't what he was doing. It just happened that way for him. He was a powerful, but he's all, if you look at Dylan, he's always truthful, man. He's like an arrowhead of truth.
Yeah. You know? I was reading in his book, he said, like, about, was it maybe 20, 30 years ago, he stopped singing his original songs in that way. He's just, I can't do it anymore. And he subconsciously sings how he thinks they should sound now. And that sounds daft, maybe. But on the other hand, it keeps him going and he's still touring and writing albums and, like, you know.
Oh, I totally agree. I think he's a great one. I love about him, the way I feel like he's really helped people like me and many others, is that because he's flawless, you know, he shows everything about himself. He just sings the way he sings and he plays the way he plays. And that, and Edwin Collins is like that, you know, and Leonard Cohen's like that. And there was a great thing with Leonard Cohen. He was getting interviewed once and he was quite old at the time. And he was receiving another award, and he was getting this award. It was full of, like, you know, cultured people in this beautiful big theatre. And he was coming up to the microphone to get his award. You can just tell by the impression of his face. He was like, you know, he gets this, like, songwriting award, you know. He probably would have been preferred having a pizza across the road. So. And he comes up to the microphone. He says, listen, he says, I just want to say something. I want to dedicate this award to somebody else. And this somebody else, you'll not know. And he's talking to the whole room. And you can hear a pin drop. He says, when I was about 14 or 15 years old, he says, I came out of my parents' very affluent house in a very posh part of wherever he lived, you know. And I crossed the lovely tennis courts, across the gardens. And as I came around the corner from the tennis courts, I saw this young man sitting on a step with a Spanish guitar. a beautiful young man with long hair, two girls sitting either side of him, and he was playing this beautiful gypsy music.
Yeah.
And he said, I was stopped in my tracks, and I just wanted to be this guy. The girls were around him. He was playing beautiful guitar. He had long hair. He was good looking. And I was just like, this is what I want to be. This is what I want. So he exchanged phone numbers, and he booked some guitar lessons off this busking guy who was only about 18 or 19, this kid, you know. So he went around every Wednesday for a few weeks getting lessons, and he learned the A minor, he learned the G, he learned the F, he learned the E7, the Spanish chords, you know. And he said on his fourth lesson, he went round and he knocked on the door, and the door opened. There was this like housewife, a woman there, and she says, oh, can I help you? He says, oh, yeah, I'm here for my guitar lesson. And the lady says, oh, I'm sorry, the young man's departed. He's passed away. He killed himself, this young gypsy guy. And Lennon was like, and he was really getting his connection with music. And then he came back to the present and he says, do you know what? I got three guitar lessons off that kid. I didn't realize how much he gave us. He says, them five chords that he gave me run through everything I've ever done.
That's beautiful. Song,
yeah.
But all the songs were made as a consequence of that chance meeting and those lessons.
Yeah. And he has the intel because he was a natural poet and a beautiful wordsmith and a great creator. But he just used the platform that he was given, and it went a long way, you know. A minor, G, F, and E7.
I'm going to play with those chords tonight, Martin, and see if something falls from the sky.
Well, it will, because you are you. You know, you are the best you on this planet. Nobody's better at being you, and that's all you have to do. You know.
Love it, love it. I don't want to take up too much more of your time, but I've got another question I want to ask, if that's okay. And then before I ask it, set the scene, is a friend of mine, Philippa, organises like gigs in Edinburgh. And
yes.
About 2 months ago, like she does the Mash House and Voodoo Room, so she maybe deals with like 200 bands a year.
Wow.
And she said, have you ever heard of Martin Stevenson? I promise you not. I was like, oh, yeah, I've heard of him. He goes, they were the most enjoyable experience I've ever worked with.
Oh, that's so nice.
And she said she met you and you gave her a CD. And it was so random that she met
her. I remember her.
Yeah, I'll send you a picture. So
yes,
but she didn't know that I met you before, Ethan, and it just happened. She mentioned this and put the seed about me trying to get in touch with you again. So
I remember her, and you know, thanks to Philippa, but you know, that's something I've learned really early on. Is etiquette is everything, you know. Like, it's so important how you carry yourself, whatever age you are. To me, like, young people are holy people. Young people are like, you can learn so much from younger people. You should never have this attitude if you're older that you're wiser and you know more, because it's not true. We're just the different points on the circle, you know. And to me, like, the age of your soul could be twice the age of my soul, but you're just happy. You're looking to be in a newer car, your vehicle that you're traveling around in, which is great. You know, it's a celebration that you have. And I've been that age, and I'm my age now, and I'm happy. And that's where whatever age I'm present with, I totally respect the soul of them, because they're all ages.
Yeah, I love it. You got me deep thinking here, sir. But on a less deep thinking, the question was about, which I've asked loads of guests, and I love hearing the stories about them. Do you have like the best gig you've ever done out of all your gigs?
Do you know, it could be just something. It doesn't, I've headlined Glastonbury, played all over the world, but sometimes them aren't the best things, you know. Like, to me, I remember playing on the Isle of Egg.
Right.
And I went there with my friend Scott MacDonald, and we were again in our early 30s. You've got all this to look forward to when you're in your 30s. It's a great time. Because something happens then, I think. You've got this knowledge that you didn't have in your 20s, and you're a bit more liberated. But I went over to the Isle of Egg, and we went over on a boat. And I had a poncho on and a beard at the time, and my hat, and my friend Scott MacDonald, he was from Glasgow. So we got to the Isle of Egg. We had to go from Oban on a boat to the Isle of Egg, and there's like there's all the Eggsters, the egg people stand. There was about 20 of them that live on the island, right? They're all bunkers. Right. Right? There was a woman in like a tartan kilt with pipes. Wes, the main honcho of the island, he looks like, you know, like a long beard and a little cap, complete stoner. His wife, Maggie. And what had happened, this island had been owned by a German guy, and he was a bit obnoxious. He wasn't really taking care of the island. And Wes and Maggie, who were like two hippies, Maggie did the Open University course and she studied law. And they got the rights of the island off the German guy back for the people. So the people owned the island again. Nice. And they were building like a little cafe. They were just going banana. They were fantastic people. I mean, there was a doctor, a plumber, just different. So we got into the island and we got off the boat and I said to my friend Scott, I said, oh, look, there's the islanders. They've come to welcome us, you know. It was like whiskey galore, you know. And I got off the boat and I went to shake hands with Wes, the guy with the beard, and he says, get out the way. I said, what's that? He says, the McEwans is coming in. They were there to get the McEwans beer. They weren't there to welcome us, you know. He just kind of pushed me out of the way. And there's like the McEwans crates are coming in. I says, well, where's the pub? He says, there. And there was just a wooden bench with loads of every McEwans cans underneath. I said, this is welcome to Scotland, like they're all, you know. And but that night we played in like a little hall that they built, and there was the whole island was there. Their dogs, babies, everybody on the island. It was probably about 40 people. And that day, I stayed in the black house for 2 nights. I just slept on a wood pallet, you know. But they had a fire in the middle of the floor of the house. I said, where's the fridge at? He says, the bottom of the garden is called a stream. You know, it was just wild. But they were brilliant, brilliant people. Like when I left, I cried when I left. I just felt like I connected. And I could see why people were on holiday and went there and ended up living there. Because there's this old way that's been lost, you know?
Yeah, it's always about the people, man.
If you do a little bit of research on the island of Egg, they're a great community, like. But I remember that as long as I lived playing there, you know?
Hey, man, it's almost an hour I've taken when I said half an hour, so apologies for that. But I've loved hearing your stories.
It's great to see you, and I'm so glad that you're doing well and enjoying, because me and Helen were very fond of when we met you.
Come on. Thanks again for your time. Great to see you.
Thank you. All the best, lad. God
Take
bless.
Care, sir.
Take care.
Bye-bye. That was Martin. I've been your host, Gavin. Hope you enjoyed this week's episode of Song Stories. Thank you so much for listening. Don't forget to subscribe to the link below. And in the meantime, have a good day.